the Comic Book of the Month podcast after a long hiatus. We appreciate all of our subscribers' patience while we are getting ourselves back on track. It's been a busy couple of months, but we are now back. It's going to be a small episode this time. It's just Dylan and
Swan
here in the studio. But we are going to give you a pretty, hopefully in-depth, look at Earthworld Volume 1, The Battle for Goblin Knob by Rob Balder and illustrated by Jamie Noguchi.
So we're not going to even try to not spoil it, anything.
Exactly. No, we are spoiling the hell out of this thing. Please, it's spoiled. And I'm also just going to give a quick shout. This episode was, air quotes, sponsored by Rob T. Balder and Earthworld.com. Because we like to make sure that wherever you can get the book and whoever likes us most, we will make sure and give them a shout on the podcast. So we talked to Rob Balder and we want to make sure that you know that you can read all of this for free on Earthworld.com. So,
of course, there are maybe 5 pages that don't exist in the online version.
So let's get to a story synopsis really quick. Basically, you've got
Parson Gotti.
Thank you. Well, yeah. If you want to do the synopsis, Parson
Gotti is a man who is very large and is definitely has a real dead end existence. He has a shitty job. No one reads his webcomics. He doesn't have much of a social life other than the role-playing games he likes to run. And so he said, you know, if I could escape into my games, boom, see ya. Mm-hmm. And that's when the plot happens and he gets transported to the magical world of Earthworld where war happens in turns. Like the game he was making. Mm-hmm. And he got summoned there because the side of Goblin Knob needed a new warlord, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth, mm-hmm. because they kept promoting by, okay, let's promote the most handsome guy.
Yeah,
he's obviously our greatest leader.
Yeah, you've got the two different sides of what is it,
Goblin Knob and so you have Ansem, who leads the coalition sides, versus Stanley the Plaid, who subsequently gets renamed into Stanley the Tool, because he gets convinced that tool is a term of honor.
It definitely is. I would think so.
I mean, you're the Tool of the Titans.
Yeah, I know. Tool of the Titans.
You're invoking the Titans' will. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, and Earthworld was created by these Elvis-looking motherfuckers, who were giant.
Yes, the Titans. So you have Stanley, who is, you know, the ruler of Goblin Knob, who is a guy who is controlled purely by his own ego and ridiculousness, and he has nobody's concern except for himself. He's short. He has a Napoleon complex, and he has the dreams of being the ruler of everything. I'm just looking at this panel on page 29 of his angry little face. it's giving me all of his backstory just by looking at his face. And, you know, it's amazing that he's gotten as far as he has purely based on the fact that he is controlled by nothing but his own id to a large degree. But, you know, as you start out in this story, you have, you know, Parson gets transported to this place and he's the new warlord for this guy who is a complete tool, and he's trying to parse out, no inadvertent pun intended, just whose side everybody's on, and he sort of comes to find out that he's on the side of the bad guys, or perceivedly the bad guys, and he has to figure out what he wants to do with that, and there's a great moment, and I'm sure you're probably going to find the page before I do, but he kind of has this moment of, huh, I guess I'm on the bad. I'm one of the bad guys. That's pretty cool.
At which point he lifts his hammer and summons a whole lot of dragons to try to scare the leaving boop out of Parson.
Oh, man. Boop. Yeah, so there's a lot going off of that really quick. There's a lot of... It seems like the writer... And I really... We tried to schedule an interview with the writer to really get him to kind of comment on this and do a quick little, you know, helpful back and forth, but we couldn't fit it into our schedule. But there seems like a certain amount of interest in ensuring that it's kid-friendly to a degree. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it's intentional, if he's trying to make kid-friendly fantasy or what, but there's a lot of, like, sort of jokingly infantilizing the names of big scary monsters with dragons and spiders, and everything in Earthworld has this kind of kid language to it. And Parson is really kind of like, I don't understand this, I hate this, why does everything have such kiddish names, much like the audience does, which is something that I actually kind of enjoyed about this book, was the fact that Parson is... Every time I had this moment of like, now why the heck would you do that? Parson seems to have the exact same comment. So, furthering getting into Parson's head and understanding the world. But at the same time, there's also moments where he shows really, like, just violent acts, or, you know, has more adult themes, where I'm like, okay, so it's not necessarily a work that's intended for children. Like, I would never give this to, what the age range would be for somebody reading this, but I would definitely say they should at least be in middle school.
I would even go farther. I probably wouldn't give this, I guess I would give it to both my little brothers. My littlest brother's 15, I think he'd be cool with it. But on the last page, there is the F word.
Yeah.
Because which is very symbolic, and we'll talk about that later when we get closer to the end.
Yeah.
But basically, throughout the whole book, whenever he wants to swear, he can't swear, and he says boop.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the world, it's like the world itself has a mind of its own, along with all of its arcane rules. Because it is not our reality. It's mm-hmm. it's a simulation of warfare. And because this is a world that is a simulation of warfare, it has all these arcane rules to just make it work like that.
Mm-hmm. On the surface, there's this very simple setup, and that's one thing that I actually really enjoyed about this book, was kind of you walk into it kind of going, okay, so you've got the kid who is unsatisfied with his real world life, you know, it's kind of Last Starfighter where it's like, mm-hmm. okay, his life kind of sucks, and you know, he wants to escape into this fantasy world, so he wants to escape into this video game or into this, you know, role-playing game or whatever. Surprise, surprise, he gets transported. But instead of fighting on the side of the good guys, he's fighting on the side of the bad guys, which is kind of your first little twist. But as you continue through the story, you start to realize that it's not necessarily the bad guys, because Ansem's kind of a dick, too.
Like, such a dick.
I don't know where it kind of started to turn for me. Once the sort of back and forth and twists and turns, people are sort of, they're on Stanley's side, and they switch to being on...
Another thing that it does is it makes lots of references to many real-world things, because part of Parson's idea is that this is all some sort of coma fantasy.
Yeah, which kind of comes and goes, and it's... There's... Oh, man. One of the things throughout this book is that I can kind of see that Baldur is finding his pace and finding his understanding of the medium as he's working through it. And so a lot of the sections are rough, a lot of the story pacing feels weird, there's a lot of information dump. You can tell that it's somebody that's trying to find their footing, and by the end of this book, I feel like he really knows what he's doing, and he really understands these characters, he knows the world, and he can get to the heart of it and really tell a great story. One of the big issues when you're first starting out is just kind of a what the hell is going on and why, while Baldur's still trying to figure out kind of how he's going to tell the story as best he can. And it, on that surface, when you're trying to kind of read his mind to be a step ahead of him, you know, it can be a little frustrating. But once you, like I was telling Swan before we started recording, you know, I read through this, and then when I went back to kind of write down notes for the podcast, I started to see all of the things that he, all the story seeds that he had planted way at the beginning when I was still trying to understand what the hell was going on. And when I'm trying to find my footing and he's showing you all these weird, intricate plot points about the world, you just, they fly past you. And then you read it again and it gains this extra layer. And I feel like it's a book that definitely benefits from rereading. And I don't know, like I was pretty excited and kind of like I said, I'm really excited to read the next volume when it comes out. I'm definitely going to. So it definitely converted me by the end, but it did take quite a ways for me to finally get there. But because it is such a hodgepodge of different references, like the world's internal logic is that it has no logic. And every time you think you've got a handle on what it's trying to do, it throws you a curveball. And it's kind of nice because it's refreshing to have something that, like, doesn't play by traditional rules, even though on the surface it's like, okay, there's the good king, and there's the bad guy, and there's all these tropes that you know, but he
subverts them.
Yeah, he subverts them in a really interesting and different way that I was really pleased with. So...
yeah, the note at the beginning of the book, the dedication is actually to Roger Zelazny.
Zelazny,
who apparently told him in 91 when it's like, tell a good story and all is forgiven.
Yeah, which is a great quote. I read that dedication too, and I was like, you know what, that's exactly what this is. It's just kind of, you know, him... just telling a good story. Like, it's... yeah, he doesn't... he's not caring about what you as an audience member think. He's just trying to...
put the story out there, yeah. Because it's a story that's seen... that, like, when you read it, it feels like it's been festering.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely not something that he, you know, thought, like, okay, this is something that I've had in my mind for 6 months. I think... mm-hmm. I haven't read anything to the effect, but I wouldn't be surprised if this idea hadn't been something that was he was kicking a can down the road for a long time. Mm-hmm. But as far as to who the target audience is, I believe that I am younger than the actual main target audience because it makes so many references to movies and TV shows that I'm simply too young to have really encountered.
There's a lot of esoteric references to, like, 1970... like, they reference Grease. There's a lot of esoteric references to films and television from 70s and 80s, and he just kind of, like, throws it in to this gigantic melting pot of a story that, like... and he just manages to get away with it. And whether or not it's for laughs, like, it just works. He makes a lot, like... Stanley's army is named the Kiss Army, and they're a gigantic bunch. I don't know what...
they're Knights in Stanley's Service. And they've all got Kiss face paint.
Yeah.
The one thing that was online that I'm really sad did not make it into the book was right when Wanda comes out for the big fight at the end. And it's like, hey, so uncroaked infantry, led by Master Prize Crokinmancer, can dance fight. And it's, at the top of the page, it was, this is a very close personal issue to us. We'd like to stress the point that this comic does not endorse a belief in Michael Jackson.
Wow.
And even just, like, all the names of all the characters, or, like, all the sides, like, Fox Mud, there's this one, Shock Spell, which has to cast this Shock Spell, or Shockamancy Spell, the code words are, Lemon Party, Tub Girl, Meat Spin, Goatsy.
it's a very large combination of internet references and just all, like, oh my god.
The Wienerammers saying YTMND when they hit the gate.
Yeah. Oh my god. But, like, at the very end, on page 157, they meet the Hippie Mancers, and it's, like, Spock and Carl Sagan and...
Those ones are actually Thinkamancers.
Oh, because one of them is the Hippie Mancer.
The Abbey, the Grand Abbey, she's one of the Grand Abbeys of the Hippie Mancers. But
it's just
Spock and Carl Sagan are Hippie Man are Thinking Mancers.
I'm sorry, but Carl Sagan's totally a Hippie Mancer.
And then on 159, which was not online.
Oh yeah, let's discuss that a little bit.
One interesting little tidbit about the book is it took forever to actually come out.
Yeah, because they're already on to like storyline 5 or something like that.
No, it's still on the second story.
Huh, okay.
You know, the problem is that it's been on the second story for a really long time. It's just that schedule slip happened really hard and life happens and whatnot.
Of course.
But, because one of the interesting things about rereading it in the print form was I had completely forgotten that they said that there were going to be these special places inserted in, and so one with the most plot in it definitely is 159, where you have, you know, the temple of the Thinkamancers, and they recognize that Parson Gotti could be the answer to their more serious problem, which is Charlie, because Charlie is owner of the Arkandish, which looks like a satellite dish and is a tool that gives unparalleled ability in Thinkamancy. He's able to. It even lets him hack into the iBooks, which is something that only Goblin Knob has. And
there's a lot of, you know, as I said, like there's a lot of interesting stuff in terms of the Arkandish, and you know, Charles kind of acts as this piece of media, like he's a controller of media, and you know, there's a lot of stuff that, you know, Rob Balder is kind of doing where he, you know, as you said, it's sort of subversive in a weird way, because he is delving into this concept of, you know, the importance of media and the importance of internet and the importance of, you know, this dish and the fact that it's more powerful than a hammer or a set of pliers. Like, he has these weird pieces of subversive commentary that are thrown in here that are really smart. I really like this book.
And then, so, one of the most important things about the Goblin Knob is that it's extremely lopsided. This is it's supposed to be like a good example of asymmetric warfare, where Goblin Knob is outnumbered 25-1, and
Goblin Knob's forces are nothing but like zombies, and they're all kind of
zombies and goblins and spiders, and the only thing that they really have that are really good are their dwagons.
Yeah, they have a flying unit, and everything else is kind of scraps to a certain degree, that they're attempting to guard a pair of pliers. Sorry, a hammer.
Hammer. From the man with a pair of pliers.
Yeah.
One of the most interesting themes, I think, is you get into this whole thing about who is fit to rule and what a sovereign is, because Stanley the Plaid
catch that.
Was liked by the previous king of Goblin Knob, Selene the Fourth, Selene Ivy, as another layer of, okay, I think I'm in a hospital.
Yeah.
So Selene the Fourth really liked Stanley the Tool, and designated him heir. It's not even so much the fact that, that Stanley is an expansionist power that makes Ansem really want to take him down. It has more to do with the fact that he's not royal. And because he is not royal, he does not have the mandate of heaven.
Yeah.
Or in this case, it's the mandate of the Titans in order to rule. And so, because he's not from that class, it gives you that Hobbesian view that, you know, No, only those who've been dictated by God, God, or in this case, the Titans, are fit to rule us.
Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I found interesting was the that dynamic of Ansem's inherent racism to a degree. Classism.
Yeah, classism.
Yeah, cut that out.
Classism.
Yeah, his classism towards, and you know, once again, that's a very common trope. Oh, funny note, Ansem's costume is the costume that Evel Knievel wears. Yep. So that should have been a clue as to his not necessarily ulterior motives, but his moral gray, considering it's Evel Knievel.
That is an interesting clue that you probably would not have noticed the first time.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's just all these sort of like subtle hints about what is really going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because as far as like when you see Stanley's origin, or at least his, you know, his backstory, you kind of wind up feeling for the guy, even though throughout this entire book, there's never a single point in time that he's likable.
No.
Like, he's never portrayed as a likable guy, but in this moment, you're like, oh, wow, he fought to the top, and he really, like, proved himself, and he's the king's successor, and that's the way it should be. And then Ansem comes along and says, you're not royal, I'm taking your house. And why the hell are you able to use that hammer? Only I can,
because
I'm royal.
I should be able to use the hammer, because I... I'm a royal.
Yeah.
And so it's just like this... Yeah, so you're just seeing this guy, just like... It's like, okay, this person's obviously inferior to me, and I'm just gonna go ahead and smash him, because I have the mandate to rule.
Right.
So it's sort of the old aristocracy,
mm-hmm.
you know, smashing down any instance of meritocracy that is.
And by the end of the book, there's this point, at least for me, where I feel like that doesn't exist anymore in Earthworld. Like, and I'm sure it may be different in later volumes, but I just feel like after the climax of that battle, it's sort of like, okay, everybody's alliances, you know, you've hit sort of zero, and now they have to rebuild. So.
Well, you will see.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure I will.
Things just keep getting worse and worse and worse,
mm-hmm.
and... All the time, and by this time, you've probably forgotten that the scenario was based on the scenario that he had invented
mm-hmm.
for his game. And so, you know, he'd done almost every single thing he could, and he's like, okay, he's in the room that has a portal to the Magic Kingdom. He's like, okay, so this is like the game I brought home. But what I was going to do at home was I was going to cheat my players. Everything they were going to do good, I was going to weasel some way
mm-hmm.
to make it not work.
Yeah.
And the only way they'd be able to win is by out-weaseling me.
Mm-hmm.
So he weasels Earthworld by uncroaking a volcano and just annihilating the entire other side.
Mm-hmm.
And so after this, after they go to the Magic Kingdom, and you find out, oh, Charlie's bad, yes.
Which you kind of knew.
Kind of knew.
Like, Charlie's the nebulous, you know, very in it for his own personal gain. Oh, Doctor Strange. Right there.
Oh. And the Scarlet Witch.
Yeah, Scarlet Witch. Yeah, so many references.
Oh, Zatanna?
Or what? Zatanna? Yeah, that'd be Zatanna. I don't know who... I guess that would probably
still be Doctor Strange. That's just Maggie.
Yeah. Anyways. So many references to so many things in this book. It's just, like... I'm sure he gets away with it in the name of parody, but it's just beautiful. Like, it's...
Actually, there is, in the very back of the book, there is huge list of the references. So, things that he actually had to, like...
Get the license
for
permission.
I'm not sure even permission, because it's just these are what these things are from.
Yeah, fair enough.
Whereas if it's just thematic if it's just referenced visually or one line, mm-hmm. then it's just So that is like stuff that's close enough that he has to say, okay, all those copyrights belong to all those people. Yeah. Wanda gets the Arkham Pliers, and she becomes attuned to them, and so really, what the fate of Earthworld was doing in this whole battle was bringing the pliers to Wanda. Her loyalty isn't necessarily to Stanley. Her loyalty is to fate itself.
Yeah.
And so another thing that's happening is you can't fight fate versus you make your own path.
Yeah, and that's one thing that was... That was... Once you sort of get... There's a few sort of existential battles of, you know, fate versus free will, and it's interesting to see that switch towards the end of the book of Parson sort of
that's Parson's battle against Earthworld, free will or fate.
Yeah,
and Parson's got the sword, which gives him leadership, bonuses for everyone he's leading. Combat, so that he could actually, you know, do some damage himself. But the biggest one is ruthlessness. So it to make Parson much more bloodthirsty than he would be, though it is sort of revealed that it's that artifact couldn't. Oh, actually, on 166 is like, okay, how much of this. Because he blows up a volcano and kills tons of people. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, how much of that was me and how much of that was the sword?
Mm-hmm.
And it's he's essentially told that, you know, the sword can't make a lion out of a mouse. Mm-hmm. It only
enhances.
It only enhances what is already there.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the defining moment at the end of the book, he gets mad at Earthworld, throws the sword away, and says, "Fuck you, I'm a player."
Mm-hmm.
You were going to say.
Yeah, so a small bit of math. At 168 pages, that's roughly 6 issues of a modern comic book.
Mm-hmm.
Not including ads. So 28 pages of content per issue. 168 pages, that's 6 issues. This is the equivalent of one regular trade paperback from Marvel or DC. So you think about how much information and how much story is packed into this book versus how much you get out of 6 issues from a regular monthly comic book company.
This is so much more.
There's so much more. Like, this would easily probably be about 3 years worth of story at Marvel or DC.
Oh, yeah.
Like, just getting to the first battle... Well... Yeah, getting to the first battle alone would probably be it would be, you know, 168 pages. Like, there's so much compression on this book of trying to give you so much information. It was really refreshing for me to be able to really feel like I got my money's worth. If Rob Balder can keep... Well, obviously he has. There's a whole other book. I mean, I don't know if he said when the next book is coming out. I guess
the content for book 2 is not yet finished.
Mm-hmm.
Though it's beginning. It feels like
it's starting to wrap up.
It feels like it's going to wrap up. It's mm-hmm. The second book is actually much more within one battle.
Mm-hmm.
And so far has only taken place on one turn.
Wow! Because he's dealing with this webcomic format, it is really interesting to see him playing around with pacing and playing around with layouts. Like, it feels like this sort of restricting medium is really helping him in the long run. And just kind of... there are certain sections and sort of innovative... Like, on page 78, there's a great scene. It's in... aerial combat moment where you see, you know, this sense of motion between the panels where you have, and you can go ahead and help me and describe the action a little bit because I'm losing character names at the moment.
So, Jillian has come off of her Gwiffen and is trying to take out Lord Manpower the Temporary, and she's kind of holding on to the mouth of the dragon that he is riding, and he's bringing up his arm and is about to stab her right in the face. When at the last moment, Arsim takes the Arcan pliers and pulls Lord Manpower away and smushes his head between the pliers.
With a yoink.
With a yoink and a split.
And yeah, it's just the way that, and I don't know who's responsible for this, if it's Jamie Noguchi or Rob Balder, I guess they can both take the credit for it. But the placement of the characters throughout the action, as you start from below the point of action looking up at her on the Gwyphon, to moving over to her dropping and grabbing the mouth, to then seeing as the panels go from, you know, these sort of squat rectangles to an even thinner widescreen perspective as you watch this battle sort of unfold and you see him raise his sword, she's holding the mouth, looks over at him, there's just this, like, elegant motion of sword, and then you see the pliers grab and then squish, and you see her, when Ansem squishes his head, you go to a close-up of him, then close-up of, what's her name?
Jillian.
Of Jillian, and then it sort of pulls out to this two-shot of their mouths as they smile at each other with one of the vampires from Transylvito kicking a dragon in the face in the background. And it's just this really elegant... Vinny from Transylvito. Just this really elegant little, like, moment of action that he just conveys really simply, and it just, like, I don't know, it really popped out at me when I was reading it, and it's just really cool to see these tiny little moments thrown throughout, and it's like he really sort of knows when he wants these moments of action, he really knows when to savor it and when to just kind of go crazy with the exposition. And it's, I don't know, like I said, it's amazing to get a comic that's so compressed and just really...
With a date from the last within the last two decades.
Yeah. I mean, the first volume definitely seems like a vast introduction of all of these players, so that by the time you get to the end of it, it's like, okay, you know the world, you know who these people are, now let's play and really see what we can do with this space. And you really get to watch these characters go through pretty large arcs within the first story in and of itself. Your final thoughts on Earthworld before we go, my friend?
I think Earthworld, it's what especially when it first started coming out, it was one of my, for a short while, was one of my favorite webcomics, just because of just how brilliant some of the strategies that he employs are, mm-hmm. and, you know, how, you know, would not have thought of anything like that. And it, more, I think, it, out of, you know, anything that is 168 pages in, like this, it surprised me more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think it is definitely worth reading.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's... Like I've said, it's 168 pages, and by contemporary comic book standards, it feels like so much more than that. And the way that it really winds up twisting your preconceptions on its head, it's really great to have a story that knows how to mess with you in a very interesting way. So, I am excited for the next volume. I can't wait for it. I know I can read it online, but...
No, you're going to wait for it. Medium.
Yeah, I am going to wait for it.
It's going to be a while.
Yeah, yeah. But yeah, I am excited. And so, yeah. Earthworld by Rob Balder and by Jamie Noguchi, who... Sorry we short shrifted you, Jamie Noguchi. We commended you once or twice in here, but the art definitely serves story in showing the cutesy world that Earthworld is in all of its warsome, cantankerous, murderous glory.
But you could definitely find more work by Jamie Noguchi on his webcomic at ypcomic.com.
Good call. Alright, so thank you for joining us. This episode was, air quotes, sponsored by Rob T. Balder and Earthworld.com. Join us next time when we will be reviewing and analyzing Captain America, Man Out of Time, written by Mark Waid and illustrated by Jorg Molina. If you want, send us your hate mail, send us your comments, send us anything you want to comicbookofthemonth@gmail.com. And you can follow us on Twitter at CBotMP. Also, we have the Facebook page, facebook.com/comicbookofthemonth. And you can leave us a voicemail at 424-CBotMP5. Yes, you can. You get a voicemail.
What?
All right. Thank you for joining us.